Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. New host Foster Moore talks with his old college roommate, David, a residence hall director at Lamar University, about what his experience as an educator has taught him about how inequity in school funding determines outcomes for children. In the second half of the broadcast, host Teresa Wilkie speaks with Michael Kay, law professor emeritus at Washburn University, about using memorandums of understanding between police officers and school administrators to break the school-to-prison pipeline. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast.
Morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice. My name's Teresa Wilkie, and I want to introduce the listeners to Foster Moore. Hi, Foster.
Hi, good morning.
Foster, you've done a really terrific job of interviewing a college friend of yours, Daniel Moore. Are you brothers, you two?
We are not. His name's Daniel Foster, and that's a whole fun story that we always made jokes that there were the Fosters in the same room. So
Danny is currently working at the university in Beaumont, Texas.
Yeah, Lamar University.
And he did his studies in public school education, is that correct?
Yeah, he did his bachelor's degree at Kansas State University in secondary education and with a minor in theater, I think it was what it was.
And so he's going to speak with you this morning. You've done a very good interview with him on inequity in public school education as it stands right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it's kind of his take on it because he student taught for a couple of semesters, actually, because he also has his master's. And so just kind of his views on it and what he's seen between here in California and Texas.
Well, we're going to take a listen to that now and say a few words after. Thanks.
Guest today is Daniel Foster. Danny, you went to college with me at K-State University, Kansas State University. Where did you get your master's degree?
I got my master's degree at Texas A&M.
Texas A&M. And what was that in?
I did higher education administration with an emphasis in student affairs.
Okay. So how much experience do you have in primary and secondary education, K through 12 schooling?
K through 12. My bachelor's degree was in secondary education with my emphasis in English and theater. So I had 3 years worth of that plus a student teaching experience.
Okay. Where did you student teach?
Student taught at Fort Riley Middle School, which is a middle school that serves entirely children of active duty military personnel.
Okay. To give us an idea of the inequity and stuff like that, what's the diversity look like?
At Fort Riley?
Yeah.
There, it was a pretty diverse group just because of the government doesn't really look at diversity statistics when it's placing people for defense reasons. And so diversity there was pretty, I would say probably 60% students of color. And aside from that, those breakdowns kind of varied because students were in and out so frequently. But probably around that, 20% mark of black and probably around that 30% mark of, Hispanic, Latino, South American identities. And then, 10%, whether it's Asian American or Native American or some conglomerate of or many of the students there.
Okay. So there's this idea that I've read a couple of different places, and I'm sure you've heard of it too, that if you decrease funding, then there's a higher risk for students to drop out of school and join less than legal organizations, I guess you could say. What were your views being on the inside? Did you feel like that was a problem?
I think colloquially, yes. I think that's probably something that takes place and is definitely a huge concern, especially when you look at, inner city schools that tend to be funded at the lowest level in a lot of places. And then you look at schools and dropout rates for, more affluent areas, places where their parents all went to college or higher property taxes tend to play into that a lot as well. And so I think that's probably something that happens a lot. In my experience, where I was mostly experiencing students that were still in that, freshman, sophomore year, that eighth grade year, It wasn't something that was really at the front of their mind, but it was definitely something that I thought about for a lot of my students when they wouldn't participate in things, or they kind of said, I just need to get, you know, get through high school and then I'm going to go, you know, do whatever it is, or, you know, kind of some of those types of things. They didn't really know what the world outside of that was like, but it was definitely a concern for me trying to get them engaged and get them to understand that they had more potential than what they were giving themselves credit for.
Okay. So you mentioned the fear of students if they didn't participate. What were you afraid to have happen? Were they to not participate and possibly become disinterested in the social aspects of school?
Well, I think when students become disengaged or when they don't find something interesting, if you don't find a way to interest students, then they're going to think nothing is interesting, right? They're going to go back to whatever they thought was interesting before school, whether that's video games or whether that's, you know, sports or whether that's, you know, hunting growing up in Nebraska and, you know, going to school in Kansas. A lot of my students like to hunt. That was kind of their fun thing. And so when they did that, that was the fear, is that they would go to that and not realize that being in school was going to allow them to do more of the things that they enjoyed and they could apply what they were learning in school into their other interest areas. And so I think that was kind of the fear, is I always wanted to make sure that I was engaging students at their level and in a way that they could really grasp the concept, because if I could keep them interested in what was happening in the classroom, I knew I could get them to be interested in other aspects, and I could get them to be interested in learning more. And so then they could apply that to their hobbies. Like I say, whether it was, you know, video games or athletics or any of those things, you could go on and they could do more with whatever they enjoyed. They could have a more fulfilling career in life.
Okay, so did you ever feel like, or in your classes, did you ever notice any trends in terms of funding for populations of students with higher or lower person of color rates?
I don't know that I saw the differences in the schools that I've been at. I think I've definitely seen it in the communities. You know, you look at different schools around and you look at the funding rates of those schools. You know, the federal government funds a pretty blanket amount to different schools, and the federal government does that. But once states and local governments become involved, those funding criteria and those algorithms are very different, and it kind of depends on that. But I think if you start to look at the research based on some of that, people of color and people, you know, first-generation students, whether they're, you know, people of color or not, tend to live in areas that are less affluent, and then affluency is directly related to, you know, increasing job status, and increasing job status is increasingly related to the amount of money you're able to make in a career. That's obviously not 100% accurate. There are plenty of people that with high school degrees that did really, really well for themselves and continue to do really well. But as a general rule, that's the thing. And so when you tie funding into property taxes, you tie funding into, you know, even sales tax in some communities, or you tie funding into all of these other things, if you're putting them in areas that are lower income, then it's a perpetuating cycle, because you're not lower income, their lower property taxes, lower funding rates for these schools. So schools are continuing to undereducate students. And if they're undereducating, students aren't being prepared well for the next step, with whatever that is, whether that's college, whether that's trade school, whether that's going into the workforce or the military or all of these things. And so when you underfund those, then they go back into these communities that are, you know, lower income, you know, they can afford and live well and live good lives. But then they're underfunding schools further, and schools are cutting things. And so, you know, it's that perpetuating cycle. And statistically in our country, you know, in the last 60 years, you know, we've started to give people of color the opportunities that white people have always had in our country. And so I think that's a huge blow as well. You know, having a 100-year head start on someone plays into the social aspect. And I don't know that everybody always sees it like that, where, you know, you look at the founding of the country, where it was, you know, Princeton and Yale and Harvard and these, you know, Ivy League institutions that were doing these really good things. It was landowners, it was men, and that's it, right? So like white men were who went to school. Well, then they were able to move into communities and raise those communities by putting money back into it. They were educated, they knew how to make business, they knew how to do these things. And then, you know, gradually we started to say, okay, maybe you don't need to be a landowner, but you still need to be a white man. Like, okay, maybe women could also do it, which was a great thing. And women are still disenfranchised a lot in the education system as well. I don't want to diminish that. You know, and then it wasn't until way later and into, you know, when slavery started to become this taboo thing in the North that people started to say, like, oh, okay, well, if you're a Northern Black person, you can go to college as long as you qualify, but only, you know, a certain amount. And so it was the cream of the crop. And even today, you know, the amount of students of color who go, you know, go on to higher education and are told that they can go on to higher education pales in comparison to their white counterparts. I don't have the exact data on that, but I know, you know, predominantly white institutions and, you know, even historically Black colleges are fewer and further between, but predominantly white institutions are called predominantly white institutions for a very, very specific reason, and they're everywhere, whereas historically Black colleges and universities are not. And so I think that says a lot about it as well. And so when you start to disenfranchise those communities, I think it's a pretty systemic issue, and I don't think it's one that can necessarily be argued a lot when you're seeing that. I think there is some personal accountability to a lot of things, but I don't know that it's necessarily education when you're educating 6, 7, 8-year-old children. I don't think personal accountability when it comes to education applies in that situation. And I think that's a lot of the argument that people tend to make.
Okay. Well, knowing that our history is a country has drifted towards white men are statistically better educated and therefore put more money in communities. And would you think that there's some, not correlation or causation, but some trend that underfunded school districts lead to a higher incarceration rate in those communities?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I don't have any like research to back that up, but I would say probably. I would think if you look at our incarceration rate, most people that are incarcerated, especially incarcerated for, you know, low-level drug offenses or, you know, low-level petty theft or even, you know, like armed robbery and some of those, you know, kinds of things, I think you look at those and very few of those people have college educations and very, you know, even fewer, you know, have advanced degrees. And, you know, the most, do they even go to high school? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know the statistics on that. But I think as you, I don't know that it's necessarily, you know, related to color, but I think it is probably related in some way or shape or form to education and education level for sure. But like I say, I don't have any statistics on that. That's purely anecdotal on my part. But I would be interested to know the statistics on that because I believe probably.
In terms of an education standpoint, what would you feel would drive students to go into something that is less illegal after the school gets defunded? Like, what do you think are some root causes for that? Because going back to what you'd said earlier with disinterest and things like that, what can we...
Get students interested. You know, that's what you do is you find a way to get students interested. And but you started early, too. You know, I think you start to look at a lot of the things that are getting cut when they cut education. Yeah, they're cutting education budgets for K through 12. But are we funding Head Start programs in communities of color? Are we funding Head Start programs in rural communities where students starting at the age of, you know, 3 and 4 before they go into pre-K? And pre-K, are we funding that? Are we getting them interested in learning early on? Are these students learning to read before they get into pre-K? You know, so then you can start to really hone in on skills and figure out, oh, this student needs some help because for whatever reason, he's not grasping his concepts, or, you know, she's hyperactive. Like, what can we do to make sure she's engaging in these things, but we're limiting her energy levels, because that's a really important thing for a student to learn. And I think a lot of those programs are getting cut. And then you look at after school programs. Are we funding after school programs? You know, Boys and Girls Club of America is a really great organization, but it's not tied to public education. It tends to benefit public education a lot, and a lot of people volunteer with, you know, organizations like that. But we're cutting programs that are funded by schools that do similar types of things like that. We're cutting those programs. We're cutting band. We're cutting choir. Sports are getting cut, you know, in a, not like, I wouldn't say a drastic rate like some of, you know, band and choir and the fine arts are, but they're getting cut way more than they used to be. And why? You know, if you give kids something to do and something that they enjoy doing, you know, computer classes, you know, a lot of kids want to learn how to code. They really like video games. Let's teach them how to do that. Let's create clubs. Let's create after-school activities. But you can't do those things when you don't pay people to do them. You know, the average educator in the last number I saw was a first year out of school, you know, with a bachelor's degree, is making anywhere between $32,000 and $37,000. That's obviously, you know, kind of off the cuff for me. I don't have a specific reference for that, but if you look at it, you're not going to find many people that fall outside of that range. So when you're doing that and then you're asking them to work a 40-hour week, you know, teaching your students along with all the prep work they have to do anyway, asking them to coach on top of that and not paying them well for that coaching gig, most places give you some sort of a stipend if you take on a coaching gig or, you know, a extracurricular advisor role or something like that. But it's pennies on the dollar, right? And there's only so much of that to go around. Who are we hiring to teach, you know, speech and debate? Who are we hiring to teach computer skills and computer programming? Are we paying people enough to get the best and the brightest to teach our students that we expect to be the best and the brightest? No, I don't think we are, and I don't think many would argue that we are. And so I think that's how you get students interested, and that's how you keep students from going and getting involved in activities that are less than savory, whether that's illegal activities or whether that's just, you know, sitting at home or, you know, sitting, you know, waiting for mom and dad to get home from work and not accomplishing anything because mom and dad are trying to put food on the table. Who's helping that kid learn to read? Is that kid reading Dickens? Probably not, you know, but is that kid reading at all? I would say probably not. If, you know, if someone's not there to tell them that reading is important and that it's fun and it has a lot to do with how you transcend all of these things, then no, he's not going to do that. And, you know, it's not even so much of, are they going and getting involved in illegal activities, which happens some for sure, but are they getting involved in activities that are going to better them and give them a future that's brighter? You know, do they have a hobby that they can turn into a career, or do they have a hobby that they can use in their career? You know, there's a, like I said, I keep bringing video games up, but there's a lot of studies out there that talk about, you know, video games helping in different aspects of life, whether it's critical thinking skills, whether it's, you know, reaction skills, whether it's imagination, you know, whether it's all these things that these video games have that. And not everyone can go into a video game kind of career, but somebody who uses that as a hobby, can they use those imagination skills in their accounting firm? Can they use those, you know, critical thinking skills in an education degree or an engineering degree? Absolutely. But are we teaching kids that those skills that they're getting from some of their hobbies are applicable? No. Do we hire teachers enough to go in depth on that? No. Are we educating parents how to have those conversations with their kids? No. And so I think that's how you get students to really engage in communities and engage in things that keep them, you know, as a lifelong learner and keep them moving up the social ladder and keep them having all of these kinds of ideas and these things. And I think that's how you do it.
Very nice. So just to kind of collect all of our thoughts and repack this giant bag that we've opened up for ourselves, keeping students engaged is a really good idea because it promotes education and their furthering. Getting them involved in community and the school sounds really like a good idea. And at a core pillar of that is funding. Yeah, would you say making sure that the schools are funded?
Definitely. And I think that's, you know, the same everywhere. I don't know that there's ever a school out there that is funded like they would like to be. I think there are definitely schools that can do more with the funding that they have. You know, like when I was in high school, my junior year, we got laptops and we took those laptops from class to class. And that was fantastic and it was great. And our school was privileged enough to be funded well enough. You go one town over and that school was lucky to get new textbooks every decade. You know, and I think that's how you fund it. And I think if you fund schools well and if you get the best and the brightest teachers and if you have after school activities, yeah, funding is the core value of that. If you're well funded, you can do these other things.
So it sounds like to fix the systematic problem, we need to start at the source, which I
exactly
agree with you, is education. And we underappreciate how much our teachers do for us and how much they do for the kids.
Exactly.
Well, thank you, Danny. This has been most helpful.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Foster, that was a really good job for your first interview. The thought that it gave me that you wanted to talk about inequity in public school funding led me to learn about the prison to pipeline, which is a current issue. It's a very important issue. What did you learn from conducting the interview?
I learned a little bit more nitty-gritty details. A lot of what Danny and I talked about in the interview, we've talked about previously, like we'd be in our dorm room at 2 a.m. just talking about the life and the world. And so we just expanded on that, and he going into the system and learning and meeting the kids really kind of cultivated this understanding that it's kind of a systemic thing and we have to work at the roots and solve it there, because otherwise there's not going to be any real change.
Children are our future, and children give us a tremendous amount of joy. They have an innocence that can be lost with age and experience. And it's well worth our time to put our efforts and attention and our funding into education of children. That gives them more options than they might otherwise have.
Exactly.
Certainly, from watching TV. And Danny is good. He continues to work with youth in the in the college level.
Yeah. He's a hall director, so he's in charge of the entire residence hall and student issues and complaints and moving in and out and any disputes and things like that. And he has a staff of, I'm going to make a number up, five, six RAs. He'll probably call me and tell me the actual number at some point. But, yeah, he's constantly looking. And he sees kids and he wants to help them. In college, he was a learning assistant. So he was an assistant to a professor teaching kids, you know, a year or two behind us. But he, you know, he would talk about his class and he would complain like everybody does about their job. But there was this little light behind his eyes that he might not have liked what he did that day. But overall, he wanted to help and see kids grow and learn and be benefited from the system and then the benefit society in return. So motivated teachers definitely help.
I think that that is the way it works. And I think to have programs that have a broad range of interest so that kids, youth can go to school but not have to do one particular thing. They can learn to be interested in the arts, in the sciences, in government, in athletics, obviously, in theater. That's a great area of interest. And your friend Danny, he's got that theater education interest. That's my older sister does that too. It's great. Yes.
Yeah, it was always really fun living with him and interacting with him because he just would bring out these random characters every once in a while, and you just look at him and go, Danny, why? But, you know, he knew what he was doing, and you trusted him, and he taught me a lot in school, too. He and I would have real deep conversations about funding and education and, you know, how to correct whatever system we were talking about. I think it was traffic laws. And it was a lot of fun. We learned a lot. We argued a lot, but it always came down to we got to start somewhere, and usually it's best to start at the bottom and work your way up. So
this is going to be our hour this morning on Jaws of Justice. I thank you for listening, and we're going to talk about – we've talked about the problems of the current inequity in public school education funding, and we're going to talk about how this impacts people with what we've learned to be a pipeline to prison – where if we don't put enough attention into schools and youth, then we can wind up with a social problem. So thank you for listening to Jaws of Justice this morning.
It's plain white house in the middle of the block where the toilet don't flush and the doors don't lock. They're staying alive on beans and rice and a big can of tuna would sure be nice. Pull back the handle on the old Frigidaire, see a half a jar of mustard and a 12-pack of beer. They steal their water from the neighbor's hose and live with the smell of unwashed clothes. Beers, four beers, six beers, ten. Daddy's passed out on the sofa again. And if he hollers, run away. Cause Daddy might kill you if you stay. Well, and Mama works days as a motel maid. She cleans 21 rooms or she don't get paid. Some days it's hard for her to make the beds with an eye swollen shut and fractured ribs. And he couldn't hold a job if they were giving him away, and it's all her fault, so he makes her pay. Cause he won't pump gas and he won't wash dishes or take no shit from them sons of bitches. is 4 beers, 6 beers, 10. Daddy's passed out on the sofa again. And if he hollers, run away. 'Cause Daddy might kill you if you stay. Kids go to school just to get a free lunch, but they don't say nothing and they can't learn much. And their blank dark eyes stare into space, makes you wonder if there's anything behind their face. And she'd leave in a minute if she had a prayer of not waking up to see him there. But there's not one chance he'd let her be, and for every day she left, he'd beat her 3. 2 beers, 4 beers, 6 beers, 10. Daddy's passed out on the sofa again. And if he hollers, run away. 'Cause Daddy might kill you if you stay. So for one more day they bruise and bleed, while the grass grows tall and then goes to seed. And it's a plain white house in your neighborhood, where you mutter to yourself, they're no damn good. 2 beers, 4 beers, 6 beers, 10. Daddy's passed out on the sofa again. And if he hollers, run away. 'Cause Daddy might kill you if you stay.
Thank you very much.
Now the calendar for January 15th. Moore Square's Kansas Issues Night is tonight, Monday, January 15th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Grandview Park Presbyterian Church, 1613 Wilson, Kansas City, Kansas. You are invited to attend if you're interested in learning more about Kansas City, Kansas firefighters' shift trading scam. Mark Holland will be there to answer questions. There will also be discussion on immigration issues in Kansas, an exoneree compensation bill they are pursuing in Kansas, new integrated voter engagement initiative in Kansas City, Kansas. The Kansas City chapter of Missouri Cure will meet tonight, Monday, January 15th, 6 p.m. at the Chestnut Avenue Family Resource Center, 3811 Chestnut, Kansas City, Missouri. They will be discussing human rights issues for Missouri prisoners, legislation pending, and begin planning for the 2018 Missouri Cure conference to be held here in Kansas City. The Kansas City chapter of Mothers in Charge Healing Support Group will be meeting Thursday, January 18th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center, Suite 124 West, 3200 Wayne Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. This group is for people who have lost loved ones to murder and violence. They will be sharing experiences in the first hour, and in the second hour, therapists and others who can help navigate the emotional and legal terrain will be available. For more information, you can find them on the web at www.kcmothersincharge.org or call them at 816-912-2601. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Now to Teresa and her guest.
We will not bow down to a high racism. Yeah. We will not bow down to injustice. We will not bow down to exploitation.
What you gonna do?
I'm gonna stand. can't tolerate.
I want to welcome everyone to Jaws of Justice, a program of 90.1 FM KKFI. So far this hour, we've heard a very interesting discussion concerning inequity in public school funding, how this occurs. Now, I'm happy to have as my guest Michael P. Kay, Washburn University Law Professor Emeritus. Michael, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, first of all, I don't have a middle name, but thank you for giving me one. It's Michael Kay, but I will tell you about myself. I taught at Washburn since 1979, where I was a teacher in the law clinic and in the classroom, and in criminal law, criminal procedure, evidence, and trial advocacy. My interest has been in community justice, in alternative dispute resolution, and labor law. And so I spent most of my time doing that until I retired about a year ago, at which point I got involved with the 501 school district here in Shawnee County. I had been the chair of the Topeka Police Department Grievance Review Board, which heard appeals by police officers regarding either contract issues or discipline issues. And that's how I got to know Major Ron Brown, who was one who helped me administer it. And he left the department. He retired, and he became the chief of the 501 Police Department. So at that point, I met him again and asked him if he'd like me to help out with the new Juvenile Justice Reform Act that came into effect in 2016, in July. And he welcomed me, and thanks to that, I've spent the last year training officers, observing them in the school setting, and learning a lot about MOUs and about the juvenile justice system. And we drafted an MOU this year as a result of this new act, which I greatly support.
Well, Michael, that is nothing short of fabulous. And for our listeners, let's have a clear understanding. Unified School District 501 is in Topeka, Kansas. It's in Shawnee County, Kansas. And our topic today is the pipeline to prison. We have a clear understanding that unequal opportunity within the public school district causes this pipeline to prison to occur. The term has emerged from our observation of the modern criminal justice system, where our understanding of the statistics on the impact of repeated involvement with the criminal justice system displays racial disparity in the statistics. And we know the problem of suspended futures when applied to children. There's a clear correlation between education and prison. Michael, explain how you became interested in this topic.
Well, I think that as a lawyer, especially a lawyer dealing with constitutional law and criminal justice issues, you can't not be interested, really, in the sociology of this, you know, why some people end up in prison, others don't, how, where you go to school, what your family is like, affects your entry into the justice system at a time when, for other people, the entry is into college. And so I was also active in the ACLU for a number of years, and I just seemed to me to be very interesting. And actually, I couldn't explain to you really, but when I saw that there was a new criminal Juvenile Justice Act, it struck me that just standing there talking to Ron was that was the way I could be helpful. And so that's sort of what brought me into it. You know, I think that from my own point of view, when we talk about racial and ethnic disparities, you know, We're talking about percentages. We're talking about different treatment for similar behavior between students of color and students who are not of color. We're talking about an unnecessary entry, for example, into the justice system and deeper penetration even. And that usually, I think, from what I've seen, is the result of criminalizing normal adolescent behavior and sometimes simply school misbehavior, that because somebody thinks they don't want to tolerate that kind of behavior in the school, it gets thrown to the justice system. And this new statute is a remarkable redoing, recasting of our juvenile justice system. Kansas gets a lot of bad publicity. There's no question about it. I just, you know, the legislator that talked about African Americans having a genetic predisposition to using marijuana, shameful publicity across the country.
Step off the committee.
And it makes national publicity because we're known for it. But this statute is remarkable, and it was passed with 100% of the votes in the Senate, an 188-5 vote in the House in Kansas, signed almost immediately by the governor, and it was the result of the legislature putting together a work group of made up of a large number of stakeholders in the justice system, legislators and prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers. This couldn't have been done better, and it's incredibly ambitious. So now the story is going to be, will it work? And for it to work, there has to be collaboration. So all this, you know, makes me very interested.
This is where you come in. I found you looking at a Capital Journal article, the Topeka Daily Capital Journal, mm-hmm. where you're the author of a model memorandum of understanding between the school district in Topeka, Kansas, and the police. So you're offering this model memorandum of understanding to all school districts in Kansas to adopt. Is that correct?
Well, we're not, in a way it is. In the first place, I think you should, let me just, for your listeners, they might want to understand what an MOU is and how I got involved in it and our district got involved in it. Memoranda of understanding are not a new device. They're not a new type of agreement. What they are is memorandums of understanding is an agreement between agencies and people who are working together. It's not supposed to be a legally enforceable agreement. It's an agreement based on trust. Some of them are like contracts, and they might actually be enforceable in a court. But basically, the actual idea behind them is that people who are working together sort of pledge to trust each other and work this out, sort of a cooperative plan. And the new Juvenile Justice Reform Act requires school districts to develop and approve what they call the Memorandum of Understanding. And not only do they, each one has to have one, and they had to have one by July 1st of 2017, this thing had to be developed in collaboration with what they called relevant stakeholders. So, for example, it would be between the school district and a law enforcement agency, the district attorney's office, the Department of Corrections. It could include community groups like the NAACP, neighborhood associations. And it's up to the school district who the stakeholders would be. And the purpose of this MOU is clear guidelines for how and when school-based behaviors are going to be referred to law enforcement or to the juvenile justice system. And the statute says, with the goal of reducing such referrals and protecting public safety. So when I saw this, I and Ron got together to work on this. And I went and took webinars, for example, from the leader an MOU production, Judge Teske in Clayton County, Georgia, who goes around the country helping districts to design their MOUs. And all these MOUs are considered to be unique to the district. So, for example, Garden City might have a very different type of MOU than Topeka would have. So we worked on that. And then we got involved. We got the general counsel for the Topeka 501 district to work with us on it. And among us, we developed a draft. We then talked to the new superintendent and asked her to convene a meeting of stakeholders. And so then we had prosecutors, we had the presiding judge of the district, we had corrections people, we had people from the school district. And that's when we discussed this particular draft that we had and to see if we could get buy-in. And then after we had done that in one large group, we met again in small groups, we worked on the language, and out of that came this collaboration that produced this MOU. Now, as far as other people go, we are overjoyed if anybody wants to use it and, you know, adopt it or change it. But for all I know that Wichita, for example, has one. Their school system is very advanced when it comes to this stuff. And there may be others that have them also. But we're willing to share it, absolutely.
Each individual school district would have to sign a memorandum of understanding with their local law enforcement.
Know whether Missouri has done this or not. This is entirely a, you know, state law thing.
We can only encourage them.
Encouraging them to do it?
Right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, here's the reason, and I'll tell you. One thing that's very important to understand is there was a Bar Journal article by a juvenile court judge who says it's a whole new world now. And he describes this new act as a complete redoing, almost unbelievably vast redoing of the justice system and the juvenile justice system. And the purpose of this, the primary absolute purpose, is to reduce racial disparities and to keep all kids out of the justice system unless they absolutely have to be there. And to make that work requires buy-in from a huge bureaucracy, in other words, and from the public. And so for that to work, the MOU is extremely important, because the MOU is something that will be in the hands of teachers, school administrators, parents can read it, the police department, the school police department.
The sheriff.
And kids know about it.
Right,
so
we see reasons.
This is a thing that'll make it run. In other words, they're like the engineering department at GM, and this thing is the car. You know, this is the operating manual for the car, and that's how we're doing it.
Right, we see the trigger of racial disparity in offenses, the number of offenses. There's a disproportionate number of Black students charged with suspensions compared to their general overall school population. And there's two things that I found in my research that caused this. One is a zero tolerance policy, an exclusionary policy. Here's the rule. Anyone who does this is suspended. And then the other is, in fact, the policing in schools. So in the modern world, we have police officers in schools. And as a result of this, we're seeing more incarceration of youth because the police have been misused in public school. So the MOU is getting away from the idea of a police officer as a hall monitor. Isn't that correct? There's clear.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, number one, yes, zero tolerance policies are inconsistent with the new law. There's no question about it. Not only that, we're not writing on a clean slate here. I mean, it's well known that zero tolerance policies feel good to people not involved in the application of the policies, but they not only don't do anything, but they don't do what they're supposed to do. They don't prevent recidivism, and they also end up being quite cruel. As far as policing in the schools go, I would say this. During this last year that I've been involved with this, I've had a chance to see police at work. So, for example, I've spent time with the officers in the 501 Police Department in the high schools and the middle schools, you know, shadowing them and seeing how they deal with that. I've also participated in training them in effective interaction with students and with school staff. And we've put on about 4 training sessions through our own 501 Police Department on this very issue, not only in our school but elsewhere. And what I've found is that, first place, police are used to being trained. Training is an important part of their work, self-training. They treat kids out here with respect. They mentor them. They're not looked upon as the enemy. And they are the one group, I would say, that is most likely to understand and treat all kids appropriately, regardless of economic or racial issue. Now, when it comes to the schools, here's the problem. And you see this not only here, but in other states. Once a police officer's in the school, the officer's in a somewhat delicate position, because they're there for safety purposes, and safety means that they'll problem solve, but they're there to prevent crime, and if there is crime occurring, to stop it or investigate it. What do school teachers think about that? Well, some school teachers understand it perfectly, others don't. And the problem that this law is intended to address, and you see it in our MOU also, is police should not be asked to do school discipline, which is the province of administrators and school staff. In other words, if a teacher is having trouble with a kid who won't put his cell phone away, you don't call the police officer in and say, take that away from him. If you're having trouble with a kid in the classroom who just won't listen or who keeps on talking and who's violating school regulations on behavior, you don't call the police officer in and say, get him out of here. And this problem, unfortunately, throughout the country, is one that police are very sensitive to, because they see, you might call it mission creep. They see the school encroaching on their, taking advantage, really, of their presence to try to use them for something they're not intended to do. And Ron Brown and I wrote an article that's coming out in February in the Kansas Association of Police Chiefs magazine about this, because once a police officer is brought into the school classroom or the school environment, and a student starts to treat them perhaps in a way they might be treating a teacher, you know, rudely, unwilling to cooperate, maybe even pushing, the officer finds that they have to deal with that as a police officer, because they're dealing, their authority is now being challenged. And what this can mean is that other kids seeing it are going to think, well, we don't have to listen to the officer. He's, you know, just, we can push him around too. So they sometimes have to take action. If they have to do that, they're now potentially going to detain a kid or arrest a kid, the one thing they don't want to do. So these problems are ones that the police are now used to facing, and the MOU should reduce that. Now, the other thing is causes of racial disparity, I don't think come, in my experience here, from these officers. Our officers are racially different. In other words, we have black officers, we have white officers, we've got officers who've got Asian background. But what happens is that kids are going to be pushed around, suspended, detained, very often, because school teachers don't understand what they're doing and think that a black kid, because they talk a certain way or act a certain way, is committing a form of school misbehavior that has to be responded to by some form of discipline. And that's one of the causes of racial disparity. You know, the only way to find out why you have racial disparity is to dig down, to try to investigate, talk to everybody, and find out why they're doing what they're doing, because we do have a black kid in Shawnee County is 4.5 times more likely to be suspended or sent to a juvenile intake than a white kid.
Well, we do have other ways to find out, Michael, and that is that, didn't you tell me you're having an upcoming event at the school building that's the national site of Brown versus the Board of Education?
Yes, we are.
And when is that?
Well, you know, there's an example of the type of process that you want to see in a community. In other words, this idea of collaboration means that since you're interested in community alternatives to detention and community input, you've got to go to the community and talk to them. So as it turns out, Ron Brown told me that there was going to be a movie shown about the prison, the pipeline to prison, the school-to-prison pipeline, and that they were having a panel, and they were going to have the superintendent on it. Ron was going to be on it. A former school board member would be on it and asked me if I'd like to join. So we're going to go there next Friday on the 19th at the Brown site. It's open to the public.
And what time will that be?
We're going to talk. You know, we're going to see the movie, and we're all going to talk about it. And we hope, of course, just as you're suggesting, that the public is there, the people who care about this issue, and we can find out what they think, you know.
We have run completely out of time, and I thank you very much for being such an interesting and engaging guest. Let's tell the people again, January 19th at the national site, which houses Brown versus the Board of Education, the Monroe School in Topeka, Kansas. And what time will that event be?
It'll be at 6 o'clock will be the film, and the film lasts about 50 minutes, and then there'll be a half an hour in discussion.
So the entire public is invited, and it's an absolutely free event.
Right.
Yes, thanks. I thank you very much for talking with me today.
My pleasure. Mm-hmm.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following comes to us courtesy of CBS out of Dallas, Texas.
Texas families say that it could save, they think, their children from suffering. But marijuana is just out of their reach. The first company sanctioned to sell it is still waiting on its first order. Andrea Lucia live in Dallas. So, Andrea, I know you spoke to the frustrated mother. What'd she have to say?
Well, you know, these patient families say that after years of lobbying for legalized medical marijuana and another couple of years waiting for the industry to get up and running, a lack of orders doesn't translate into a lack of interest, but rather difficulty getting a doctor to prescribe it. There's only 8 doctors in the state that are currently allowed to do so, and none of them are here in North Texas.
It's so frustrating to know that it is there. And, you know, that we're not able to access it yet.
We first met Patty Bates Ballard and her son.
Hey, darling, how was your day?
Last February. Corey is one of thousands of Texans with intractable epilepsy who qualify under state law to use medical marijuana.
We're ready. We're ready to try this. We're past ready.
Bates Ballard is hoping it can put an end to her son's seizures, like this one caught on video last year.
Come on, Corey. Come on, buddy. There's no way to understand what it's like to have your child go through a seizure if you haven't actually experienced it.
But Bates Ballard says she was told this week UT Southwestern, which employs Corey's doctor, is not yet allowing physicians to prescribe cannabis. We asked the hospital if that was true. After 2 days, we still have not received a response.
I wanted to have every possible treatment available.
Dr. Michael Newmark in Houston is one of the 8 neurologists registered with the state to be able to prescribe cannabis. He says he plans to use it cautiously and only after ruling out more conventional medication.
We really don't know how effective it is at different doses, what the maximum doses are, what the minimum dose is.
Bates Ballard says her son has tried conventional methods.
We've got to have our doctors ready and willing to prescribe it.
Now she's fighting to try something new. Another mother told me that she was having to walk her doctor, her child's doctor, through the process of registering for this. She blamed a lack of outreach to the medical community. Now, Knox Medical, the licensed medical marijuana dispensary, said it is working with doctors and directly with patients to try to help them navigate this system. Reporting live in Dallas, Andrea Lucia, CBS 11 News.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions decided to put an end to this legal marijuana.
And we're going to see more marijuana use, and it's not going to be good.
I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
1, 2, 3.
Here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.